The Trump administration's hostile attitudes towards the press have real-world implications.
For the first time in my life, I don't feel particularly safe working here in the United States.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway for October 15th, how journalists are responding to increasingly ugly rhetoric against the media. Also on the show, a look at growing tensions between President Trump and his favorite news network with Jane Mayer.
They've been warring a little bit because Shepard Smith was reporting stories that did not reflect flatteringly on Trump.
Plus, a non-emergency welfare visit led to the fatal shooting of Fort Worth resident Tatiana Jefferson by a police officer. Now advocates are demanding accountability.
If you cannot be safe in your own home, I have to ask, where is your safe space?
But we start with Trump's war on the press. Let's get moving. President Trump has attacked the press as a core element of his administration, dismissing critical coverage as, quote, fake news, and insulting journalists and outlets at every turn.
These are just dishonest, terrible people. I'm telling you that. Terrible.
I called the fake news the enemy of the people, and they are.
You've set a new bar today for being contentious with the press corps, kind of calling us losers to our faces and all that.
No, not all of you, just many of you.
All right, fine.
Can you give us a question?
Don't be rude. No, I'm not going to give you a question. I'm not going to give you a question.
Can you stay categorical?
You are fake news.
Not only fake, it's corrupt.
This past weekend, in a video that was played for supporters at a conference at Trump's Miami resort, the president's face is superimposed on a body of a man who is shown brutally assaulting journalists, politicians, and activists in the so-called Church of Fake News. In response, the White House press secretary tweeted Monday that the president hadn't yet seen the video, but, quote, strongly condemns it. In the United States, the media environment has changed drastically over the past several years, and a few high-profile events have left many journalists with a sense of unease. Last year, five employees of the Capital Gazette in Maryland were killed when a gunman entered their office and opened fire. And we also just marked 1 year since journalist Jamal Khashoggi was tortured and killed by Saudi officials in Turkey. Earlier this month, we spoke with Jason Rezaian, a colleague of Khashoggi's, who said he's alarmed by the Trump administration's reluctance to condemn the Saudi government for Khashoggi's killing.
For the first time in my life, I don't feel particularly safe working here in the United States. And it's not because of any imminent threat that I face, but being in the country, in the city, where we are supposed to uphold the First Amendment more vocally and staunchly than anywhere else in the world, we're hearing crickets right now.
Joining me now is Joel Simon, Executive Director of the Committee to Protect Journalists, and Olivia Nuzzi, Washington Correspondent for New York Magazine. Thanks to you both for being with us.
Thank you. Great to be on.
Olivia, when you saw the initial, what was your initial reaction when you saw the video that was played at Trump's Florida resort?
I was sickened by it. I think it's one of the more explicit, gruesome reflections of the president's anti-media rhetoric to emerge in the last 2-3 years. And for me, it was something sort of snapped. You know, I'm used to hearing about the fake news. I'm used to having contentious interactions with, if not the president, then his allies, his staffers, people in the administration, his supporters. But to see something depicted in an almost silly way that's so serious, when, as you already said, there was a shooting in a newsroom a year ago, there are mass shootings on what feels like a daily basis in America, it just felt like beyond anything I had seen before.
Joel, you're nodding your head to Olivia's reaction here. I mean, where does this video fit into the president's overall relationship with the press? And we should be clear that the president has, at least through his White House press secretary, said that he condemns the video and that he hadn't seen it yet. But this was also created by his supporters.
Yeah, well, first of all, it is my job. I'm on the Committee to Protect Journalists to condemn this kind of disgusting, horrific video that depicts violence against journalists. There's nothing funny about it. At the same time, we have to recognize that it's a deliberate provocation. And this is a pattern that we've observed from President Trump and his supporters. So whenever we engage in condemnations of these kinds of videos, in some ways we're changing the subject. In some ways, we're allowing the people who are producing these kinds of videos, or the president himself, when he uses this kind of anti-media rhetoric, to change the subject. And so we have to ask ourselves why. Why is this a moment when somebody might want to change the subject? Well, we can look at, you know, what's happening in Washington, what's happening in Syria, the criticism the president is facing in the media. That is vital. It's vitally important that we stay focused on the big stories. We have to condemn this horrific video, which is really a reflection of the kinds of attitudes that many of Trump supporters, the kind of attitudes they have towards the media. At the same time, we have to have the awareness to recognize what this is and to recognize that we're being goaded.
As a journalist, Olivia, is your job harder right now? And what I mean by that is, are you concerned for your physical and personal safety, or is it just harder to grapple with an administration that's as contentious as this one is towards the press?
I don't think you can have that conversation without talking about your individual privilege, right? I am a white woman attending these events. I am in no way in the same amount of potential danger as a reporter of color. I've only felt unsafe at a handful of events before. And I can't imagine what it would be like going into a Trump rally feeling as though the crowd hated me. I'd say it's more of a distraction. You'll be having an interview with somebody and you're trying to get an answer, get some insights, and often the conversation is derailed by them attacking the media and mimicking the president. And I think they do that because of the audience of one theory, that they know that the president will see it, he'll read it. And they also do it, I think, because they believe it themselves, or they've at least convinced themselves that they believe it.
Joel, I want to get in deeper into this discussion about being distracted. I'm curious to know what, number one, what are we being distracted from? And number two, to Olivia's point, you know, you're trying to do an interview about policy. You're trying to do an interview about, you know, the latest executive order. And as a journalist, you've got a couple of minutes, an hour, whatever it is, a short amount of time to get these answers. And you're being, the conversation's being taken over by talking points. So A, what are we being distracted from? B, what is our job to, you know, how are we supposed to manage that?
Well, first of all, President Trump actually said to Leslie Stahl in an interview, she asked him, why do you always attack the media? And he said, so when you criticize me, nobody will believe you. So he's claimed, you know, to the extent we take him at his word on something like this, that this is a deliberate strategy. So it's made life more difficult. But I do think there's an where it's really made life difficult is not in this country. That's something that people need to understand. There's a lot of amazing accountability journalism happening. There's a lot of journalists who are unafraid, who are really taking on Trump and doing really top-rate critical reporting. Where this kind of rhetoric is immensely damaging is outside this country, because it's giving solace and succor to tyrants and dictators around the world who are cracking down on the media, who are invoking fake news as the rationale for these crackdowns, who are actually passing laws criminalizing fake news. The Khashoggi murder, the response of the Trump administration to that horrific crime, the indifference that it showed, has given green light to those who use violence around the world to intimidate journalists. So I do think it's having a tremendous impact in terms of the global press freedom environment.
Olivia, I want to talk about the strategy here. And often we see this with, I think most famously, Jim Acosta from CNN and the president. We also saw it recently with Reuters reporter Jeff Mason and the president in a press conference with the Finnish president the other day. I mean, is this, should reporters be more cautious? Should they be more confrontational? How do reporters respond to these direct and aggressive remarks from the president?
I think you have to take it on a case-by-case basis. I think sometimes it is worth responding to the president, or really saying, you know, what do you mean by that? I think it's better to try and get him on the record explaining why he speaks the way that he speaks, and if he understands the stakes, if he understands the implication of referring to the media in the terms that he does, as we were just talking about what the implications are globally. But I think oftentimes it's also a distraction, and it derails a press conference. It allows the president to change the topic, and we might be better served by just putting our heads down and asking questions about the news of the day.
I couldn't agree more. And I think that there are three basic impulses. You know, one is he's just exploiting antipathy towards the media that just sort of rallies his base. The second is that he's genuinely annoyed and upset by this kind of critical coverage. And the third is, I think, you know, he does believe, and it's just his modus operandi, that you go full guns blazing after your enemies and he considers the media to be an enemy. So,
But at the same time, he does love the press.
He loves attention. He loves
individual reporters, even if he does genuinely get frustrated. I don't think it's all phony. I think he clearly does. I know that he does. We all know that he does get angry at the press. But at the same time, I sometimes get the sense when he is attacking a reporter that I know that he is fond of. There's sort of this sick projection at play, too, with him that I think is a part of all of this.
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting. And I have a lot of conversations with reporters who covered the Obama administration and actually found it more difficult and frustrating because, first of all, there was a very aggressive policy towards leakers and a very active protocols in place to limit leaks. And there was a certain amount of discipline in the White House and there wasn't as much leaking. And it was frustrating.
Right.
And second of all, Obama did something that journalists really hate, which is he ignored them. You know, and Trump doesn't ignore you. So it's a more complicated dynamic. And that's why I think whenever we talk about the impact of Trump's rhetoric in a domestic context, where the argument, I think, is much more straightforward, and which is why I try to steer it towards that, is the impact this is having outside the United States.
I'm glad you, Joel, I'm glad you raised the Obama administration, because I recall when Obama was in office and the difficulties that a lot of reporters had in trying to get information, even though there was a war room, per se. There were regular press briefings. Yeah. But I want to point this out. A few days ago, a local reporter in Nashville asked Secretary of State Mike Pompeo a series of questions on Ukraine. I'm sure you both saw that. He responded by accusing her of working for the Democratic National Committee. And she asked him, and she repeated the question about three times. You know, what do you do with that, Joel?
I think that's more of a question for Olivia. I'll just say I was impressed with the fact that she seemed not to be thrown off her game.
Olivia, to that point, first of all, what should that reporter have done, or you know, how do you?
I thought she handled it in a completely professional and admirable way. I thought it was kind of a masterclass in what you ought to do in that situation. It's a bit different on camera. It's sometimes harder when you're doing a print interview or when you're not being seen to keep things on track because no one is watching it go off the rails. For the administration, you know, I mean, we see this all the time. If you see like Stephen Miller CNN or something like that, where he agrees to go on the show, or any of those officials agree to go on a show, and they eat up the time, or Kellyanne Conway or Chris Cuomo, they eat up the time by fighting. And no important questions are, you know, answered. We get no insight into anything other than the character of the people in the administration. And I do think that there is value to that. I think there's always value in having administration officials on the record, you know, in front of the world. I think the alternative is allowing them to operate in the shadows.
And which we've seen. I mean, we haven't had a press briefing in the White House in more than 200 days.
Yeah.
Joel, does that matter?
It matters in some ways. I think it doesn't matter terribly in terms of, you know, is there some essential bit of news and information that we're not getting because there are no White House press briefings? Probably not. I don't think news has been made in White House press briefings for a long time. Here's where it matters. And again, I always put this in a global context. It's a bit of theater, okay? And in that theater, what happens is journalists ask these aggressive probing questions of officials and try and hold them accountable, and they squirm away. Well, that image actually has some value in terms of, you know, the American public just seeing journalists work in that way, and around the world. It just, you know, this it's a pretty rare thing where, you know, journalists are asking these kinds of aggressive questions and officials are sort of squirming and trying to respond. So, you know, that bit of theater had some value, and I think it's unfortunate that we don't have that. In terms of the news value, I think it's pretty limited.
Olivia Nuzzi is Washington correspondent for New York Magazine, and Joel Simon is the executive director of the Committee to Protect Journalists. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
For years, President Trump has enjoyed a mostly cozy relationship with Fox News. But in recent months, the president and his favorite network appear to be increasingly at odds. A recent Fox News poll found that 51% of respondents favored impeachment and removal from office. The president took to Twitter to criticize this poll and the network. And there also seems to be tension within Fox around the coverage of President Trump, particularly in light of the ongoing impeachment inquiry. Last Friday, anchor Shepard Smith abruptly resigned after 23 years with the network.
Even in our currently polarized nation, it's my hope that the facts will win the day, that the truth will always matter, that journalism and journalists will thrive. I'm Shepard Smith, Fox News, New York.
That's Smith signing off for the last time. Meanwhile, last Wednesday, Attorney General William Barr had a private meeting with Rupert Murdoch, the executive chairman of Fox. Joining us now is Jane Mayer, chief Washington correspondent for The New Yorker. Jane, welcome to the show.
Good to be with you.
So Shepard Smith's departure on Friday from Fox News was sort of, it was abrupt, it was surprising. Why did he leave?
Well, it really was a showdown between the news side of Fox, he's a news reporter who's trying to get facts across, and the opinion side of Fox, which are the nighttime hosts like Sean Hannity and others. They'd been warring a little bit because Shepard Smith was reporting stories that did not reflect flatteringly on Trump. It came down to a fight over a particular guest who had said that the developing scandal in Washington involving the Ukrainians could be a crime that involved the president. And Shep Smith stood up for that guest, and the opinion side, Tucker Carlson, took issue with it, and they had a fight between the two sides of Fox. The opinion side evidently won. Shep Smith is leaving.
And on Monday, Fox News anchor Neil Cavuto issued a rebuke to the president, which was also quite a surprise. Let's take a listen to a little bit what he had to say.
You're right to say the media isn't fair to you, that they're more inclined to report the bad than anything good about you. So it is no surprise you're frustrated that more aren't in line with you and that everyone at Fox might not be in lockstep with you. You might even think that those who are work for you. They don't. I don't. Hard as it is to fathom, Mr. President, just because you're the leader of the free world doesn't entitle you to a free pass. Unfortunately, just a free press.
Jane, a couple of things to break down there. I mean, the first is that Cavuto is talking directly to the president. Is this typical? I mean, were you surprised by his approach here?
Well, I mean, it makes sense that he would address the president directly because the president spends so much time watching Fox and then retweeting things that he's seen on Fox. I mean, there's a continual feedback loop between Fox News and the Trump White House, which is extraordinary. I mean, having covered White Houses since Reagan's era, I've never seen anything like it. When Fox was founded by Roger Ailes, it was founded in order to make sure that if there was ever another Watergate kind of scandal involving a president like Nixon, who Ailes had worked for, that that president would have at his disposal what's basically his own propaganda network. And that's what Fox really was designed to do, to be both a sword and a shield for a conservative president. And that's what you're seeing here, is it's struggling between being that and also trying to have any credibility at all as a news operation.
Well, and to that point, I mean, Cavuto is clearly saying, we don't work for you, you being the president. Is Cavuto basically signaling that more anchors at Fox will feel a need to be more critical of the Trump administration, or that this is a new beginning for the network in terms of how it approaches being independent versus working for the president?
I'm skeptical that Fox will really break away in any big way from Trump. They have kind of a codependency. Fox makes a tremendous amount of money. It makes about $2.7 billion a year, Fox News, and it's the largest rated cable network in the country, cable news network. And so Trump has been a good thing for them in terms of profits. And at the same time, Fox has been an extraordinarily good thing for Trump. It keeps his base in line, and it tells them only what he wants them to hear for the most part. So there's been this kind of lockstep thing. The problem is Trump is getting to the point where he's hard to defend. And so you even have Tucker Carlson, the evening news opinion host, who's quite close with Trump, writes an op-ed saying this business of asking foreign countries for dirt on Trump's political opponents, he says it's hard to defend. You can't really defend it. But what Tucker Carlson argued in his piece was this shouldn't be impeachable, he's saying. But he's admitting Trump's getting hard to defend, even for Fox. They're almost in lockstep with him still. I mean, they are. Fox is acting very much as his defender almost all the time. And the fact that it's not 100% is what's creating the news here. But it's very much in his corner still and very much misinforming the country about what's going on in Washington and with Trump.
And does it matter if the news side if folks like Shep Smith leave, given, you know, everything that we just talked about as far as what the network's overall goal is to support a conservative president? I mean, does that really matter, you know, if the folks who are trying, at least in some capacity, to be as journalistically objective as they can walk out? I mean, you know, and opinion hosts remain in their positions.
Yes, it's hugely important because Fox is the largest rated cable news network in the country. And if the people who actually report the news with some kind of balance are leaving, what you've got left is more and more of just a propaganda network. I did a long story where I interviewed lots of people, including many conservatives, including many people who had worked at Fox in the past. And what they're warning is that it's becoming more and more state TV. And that is something we've not seen in this country before.
Last question for you. Any idea whether or not we might see Megyn Kelly make a return to the network, given the high stakes 2020 election?
Well, she's making an appearance on Fox and reportedly, and I would not be surprised if she comes back.
Jane Mayer is chief Washington correspondent for The New Yorker. Jane, thanks so much.
Great to be with you.
Over the weekend in Fort Worth, Texas, a white police officer entered the backyard of 28-year-old Tatiana Jefferson and fatally shot her through her bedroom window. At the time of her death, police officers were responding to a non-emergency welfare check made by Jefferson's neighbor. The police officer, named Aaron Dean, did not announce himself before shooting Jefferson. Her 8-year-old nephew was in the room with his aunt when she was killed. Officer Dean resigned on Monday morning and was subsequently arrested and charged with murder. Earlier this month, just a 40-minute drive from Fort Worth, former Dallas police officer Amber Geiger was sentenced to 10 years in prison for entering the home of Botham Jean and shooting him to death in his own living room. Janae Nelson is here to talk about the killing of a Tatiana Jefferson and what precedent there is for something that starts as a welfare check to go so wrong. Janae is Associate Director Counsel of the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund. Welcome back to The Takeaway, Janae.
Thank you, Tanzina.
Remind us of the specifics of the incident. This started with a non-emergency call. What happened next?
That's correct. Tatiana Jefferson's neighbor noticed that her doors were open at about 2:30 a.m. and that the lights in the house were on. And he thought that that was not typical of her home to be that way. So he called 311 to say that he thought they should come and check just to make sure that his neighbor was okay. So it was very clear by not only him dialing 311 as opposed to 911, but also explaining that this was just atypical behavior and he wanted to make sure she was okay. If you listen to the tape, the dispatcher asks about whether any cars are in the driveway, you know, effectively establishing it that it seems like someone is actually home, but the doors were open, which was a peculiar circumstance. And unfortunately, that very innocent and caring act turned into something fatal and deeply, deeply tragic because of an officer's horrible judgment and presumption of criminality in this neighborhood.
So we keep saying welfare check. How often do we see instances when communities of color ask for help, but they end up becoming victims to law enforcement in the process?
Well, what we do know about the Fort Worth Police Department is this is the seventh civilian shooting since June. If you think about the fact that we are only in October, that concentration of killings is absolutely alarming. They, as far as I know, are not related to wellness checks, but they speak volumes as to the relationship between the Fort Worth Police Department and the community that it is required to serve and protect.
I'm wondering, what should a welfare check look like, Janae? Because the officers in this case had their guns drawn when they arrived on the scene. They snuck into the backyard. You mentioned earlier the sort of the presumption of criminality. Is that typical when officers enter communities of color? And what is a welfare check supposed to be?
Well, one of the things that is somewhat uncertain in this circumstance is whether this was treated as a wellness check or whether it was being treated as an open structure call. But what we can say is that even if it were treated as an open structure call, meaning that there is a physical structure where access is open and therefore there's a question as to who might be inside, the officers did not have the right to not announce themselves, to shoot into the structure. They are specifically prohibited under the policies of the Fort Worth Police Department from doing so. You are never to shoot into a structure unless the officer is under a direct threat. And there was no evidence of that in this circumstance at all. He immediately shot as he was saying, "Put your hands up." Ms. Jefferson had no opportunity to identify herself, no opportunity to know who was lurking in her backyard. And it was really one of the most split-second decisions that I think we've seen in this array of horrible police shootings. And if you cannot be safe in your own home, I have to ask, where is your safe space?
Janae, is this a matter of better training for police? It's something that comes up every time there is an incident, a shooting like this. Or are there other people who would be better suited to make these welfare checks in any community, really?
Well, I think that's a combination of a number of factors. Of course, there should be better training of officers who may find themselves in these situations, even if we have a cadre of individuals who are specifically trained for wellness checks. Police have to interact with the public in myriad ways, and they should be able to do so in ways that are non-threatening, that are not lethal, and that do not presume the criminality of the individuals with whom they interact. So that's one potential solution, but we're really talking about an entire overhaul of how we imagine public safety. The idea that police officers come to a home with guns drawn without checking simply to see what is happening, the fact that there's so much fear and frankly cowardice in the interaction with these communities is deeply concerning. Of course, it would be very helpful if we also had a social structure that enabled ambulance workers or folks who are trained in paramedics to perhaps check on individuals if there's some sort of concerning behavior, as there was here, where the doors were open in the middle of the evening and a neighbor wanted to check, that it should not have been something that a police officer with a gun drawn attended to.
Well, that police officer in question was Aaron Dean. He's the person who shot and killed Jefferson. Since then, he's been arrested and charged with murder. Does his arrest indicate that there could be accountability in this case?
Well, I certainly hope there will be. I think that the swift action here is certainly a positive indication that this is going to be taken very seriously. It's hard to imagine a case more egregious than this one where it would not be. But of course, we've seen some of those, and it's very encouraging to know that he was arrested and charged with murder so quickly. And I think the Fort Worth Police Department has acknowledged that there were very concerning behaviors here, including violations of policy, in addition to trying to describe her and describe the incident through oil on the fire by including images of a firearm. So the misconduct continues, and I'm happy to see that the Fort Worth Police Department at a minimum made this arrest, but this is just the beginning. We have to see this case to fruition. This officer needs to be tried by a jury of his peers, and we need to see justice done on behalf of Tatiana Jefferson.
This killing comes on the heels of the Amber Geiger case. Officer Geiger was sentenced to 10 years recently for her role in entering an apartment that she assumed was hers and killing Botham Jean, the black resident of that apartment, who was, I think, sitting in his living room watching television. She's since been sentenced, and I'm wondering if the outcome of that case changes the conversation around this one. As I'm sure you know, there are many parallels being drawn between the two incidents.
Well, Amber Geiger was sentenced to 10 years in prison for killing and disposing of the life of Botham Jean, as you mentioned. One can debate whether that's sufficient justice for that family in that circumstance. What this circumstance with Tatiana Jefferson shows is, again, that even being in the presumed safe space of your own home does not make you immune to police brutality. And that is, I mean, such a profoundly concerning thought in our society. If your safe space is not in your home with your family, then where is it? Where does that leave us? And I think those are questions that we must ask ourselves as we think about rethinking and reimagining public safety and the role of police in our society.
Janae Nelson is the Associate Director Counsel of the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
That's our show for today. At the top of the hour, we talked about the Trump administration's confrontational relationship with the press. If you missed it, you can find that conversation on our podcast. And we asked our listeners to weigh in on this. If you work in the media, how is this affecting you?
This is Ted Yaffe calling from Freehold, New Jersey. We can't live our lives in fear, but as a network television camera person who's often worked as a pool camera at campaign events, I've sometimes found myself in the uncomfortable position of having POTUS point at me during a rally and say, "There they are, the lying press, the enemy of the people." All it takes is one unstable or violence-prone person to change the equation from a president who has a fundamental lack of understanding of the role of a free press to the provocation to a bloodbath. I cannot emphasize enough how extremely dangerous this is, and I really wish you would stop.
Keep giving us a call at 8778-MY-TAKE, or you can send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.